Edward Snowden in the summer of 2012-2013, he was signing on as someone else. Why? Because he was using other people's privileges, because he had convinced a certain number of system administrators to share their passwords. At the same time, other system administrators were not entering the campus, but signing on. Why? Because that was Edward Snowden pretending to be them.
Hi, everyone. Before we start with today's interview, we're holding our annual Hybrid Identity Protection, HIP, conference in Charleston, South Carolina at Charleston Place, October 7th through the 9th. The HIP conference and HIP community were created to educate, connect, and support the professionals working daily to protect hybrid identity environments from modern cyber threats. We have distinguished speakers from both the private and public sector, such as former Director of CISA, Jen Easterly, and former National Cyber Director, Chris Inglis. Whatever your role or industry, if your organization runs on-prem Active Directory and in the cloud Entra ID or Okta, the HIP conference is for you. Go to hipconf.com, that's hipconf.com, to sign up. Use the code WHATISHIP for a 10% discount.
Hello, and welcome to the HIP podcast. This is Identity Breach Confidential, our special mini-series on incident response, a focused deep dive into the strategies, stories, and lessons learned from the front lines. I'm your host, Jeff Wickman, Director of Identity Forensics and Incident Response, and a former ransomware negotiator. Today, I'm here with Chris Inglis, a true pioneer in cybersecurity leadership. Chris served as the first National Cyber Director of the United States and as Deputy Director of the NSA for 8 years. He's also a former Brigadier General in the U.S. Air Force and has spent more than 4 decades in public service shaping the future of national cybersecurity. His career includes serving as the Commissioner on the U.S. Cyberspace Solarium Commission, a visiting professor at the U.S. Naval Academy, and an advisor to the Department of Defense and Intelligence Community. Chris has received numerous honors for his service, including the President's National Security Medal and the DNI Distinguished Service Medal. Chris, thanks so much for joining us. Really glad to have you here.
Hey, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be with you. I think the truest thing you said in that opening was that I'm a pioneer, meaning I'm older. So we're happy to share some of that experience and hopefully it'll be good for somebody.
Wonderful. All right. So back in 2013, while serving as the NSA Chief Operating Officer, Chris found himself at the center of one of the most consequential cybersecurity incidents in U.S. history. Edward Snowden, as we all know, then an NSA contractor, leaked a massive trove of classified documents, exposing the inner workings of U.S. surveillance programs and sparking a global debate about privacy, national security, and government accountability. What played out over the summer was more than just a media firestorm. It was a stress test for the entire agency. While much of the public discussion focused on the leaks themselves, there is a deeper story about what was happening inside the NSA during those critical months, what signals were missed, and how organizational silos and unconnected systems left the agency vulnerable. So today, we're going behind the scenes. Chris, let's start right there. Can you take us back to that moment in 2013 and walk us through what just happened?
Well, I really don't like to go back to 2013, but given the offer, I'll take it. Most would remember that in the early part of June of 2013, Edward Snowden shows up in Hong Kong and proposes to make a revelation in his view. In my view, they were allegations about a broad set of collections undertaken by the National Security Agency, which he alleged intruded upon U.S. person, and for that matter, foreign person privacy in egregious ways beyond the rule of law. Edward Snowden essentially started that crusade a year before. He'd had a workplace incident. He got angry. The record would show that instead of getting mad, he proposed to get even. He began to collect information in the summer of 2012. In the fall of 2012 and into the winter of 2013, he found a moral overlay to justify that and to try to determine how he might embarrass NSA by meeting Glenn Greenwald, Ellen Poitras, who were the reporters that helped him go to market. What Edward Snowden did was to take advantage of some seams we had in our security architecture. We could track IT issues, events of consequence, and had thresholds that would then cause us to engage those. If they were something that needed to be evicted, we could do that. We had a separate physical security system that would determine that someone or something was on the campus that shouldn't be. And we, of course, had a personnel system that would address issues in the workplace. But those were separate from one another, in the case of the personnel system, because the abundance of caution looking to protect the privacy of individuals, we always try to kind of counsel and get back to kind of good status. The physical system and the IT system was just an accident of history that we didn't repair, where we thought that those were separable kind of separable systems of interest. But if you kind of looked at Edward Snowden in the summer of 2012, 2013, he was kind of coming into the workplace on certain days and not signing on to those kind of those IT systems. Why? Because he was signing on as someone else. He was kind of going to other physical campuses at odd moments of the day or night and not signing on there either. Why? Because he was using other people's privileges, because he had convinced a certain number of system administrators to share their passwords. At the same time, other system administrators were not entering the campus but signing on. Why? Because that was Edward Snowden pretending to be them. If we'd simply correlated the physical and the IP systems, you would have caught that. You would have said something's not right here. And if we would have tipped and cued both of those systems, the IT system and the physical system, that Edward Snowden was an angry young person in the workplace, possibly for good reason, maybe not, but nonetheless with extraordinary privileges, we probably would have turned up kind of our interest in what does he do. But Edward Snowden did the low and slow attacks across 2012, 2013. When he finally came out and told the most titillating, virally interesting stories in June of 2013, it was already too late to repair the harm that was already underway. What I learned out of that, separate and apart from the obvious of connect your systems, was that if someone can tell a story about you, about what you do in a malignant, malicious way, you have to go first. You can't go second. So that's perhaps the second big lesson on this. And the third lesson might be, and I think we did prepare well for this, that if you can imagine, whatever the low probability might be, that there's an event that would lead you down a slippery slope into crisis or disaster, you need to prepare for that. Practice, practice, practice is the moniker. And think your way through, what would you do if you couldn't manage the situation with your own resources? That's when you moved from emergency to crisis. Do you have some pre-established advice, counsel, assistance? Do you have friends? Do you have a coalition that you can rely on? Turns out we did, and that coalition came to our assistance. It was the Congress, it was other intelligence agencies, it was overseers who stood in to say, no, this isn't what Edward Snowden alleges. But if we had not prepared that way, it wouldn't have simply been a summer in Mordor, it would have been a summer of disaster for the National Security Agency. That's perhaps the wave tops on that, that probably occasions lots of questions about what actually happened in any one of those boxes and possibly open a few more, but I'll leave that as the opening statement.
Very cool. So, Chris, tell me, you mentioned that the NSA had organizational silos and technical blind spots that contributed to the breach or the incident. You know, how long did it take for the NSA to identify and then resolve those types of issues? I would imagine they have by now, but did they?
Yeah, there's two really great questions nested in what you just asked. One is kind of the silos, which at a moment like this, it's sometimes easy to say, let's kill all the silos. Let's just make it one kind of 50-mile wide and half inch deep organization, connect everything to everything. That's not sensible because you need the depth of expertise that only silos can generate. So in our case, we needed a depth of expertise in how to reconstitute the physical security required to manage global campuses, plural. How do we develop IT security in depth so that we can manage kind of a virtual architecture? And how do we have a personnel system that can be discrete at some moments and perhaps sharing appropriately at other moments? But that's a silo too, and so I wouldn't kill the silos. You've asked, how do you actually quickly identify that there's been a failure to connect the dots across those silos. Turns out that's wickedly easy once you sucker the event, right? Hindsight is always 20/20. And once you know what the answer is, it's really easy to track the answer back to the incipient conditions. So it took maybe a day or two to figure out that that had happened, but it's too late to have fixed the damage. The third question then is, what do you do to fix that? How do you, without killing the silos, because that's where depth of expertise comes from, connect those so that you have some reasonable tipping and queuing, and not just in the moment of a crisis, but before that, so that you can detect the rise of something and deal with that. That requires perhaps a cultural change, which is making everyone understand that while they might have a piece or a silo within the larger enterprise, that we're all accountable for the success, in a single definition, the success of the larger enterprise, so that anyone can say, I have to think horizontally as much as I might think in my lane, in my silo. And then two, have some specific thresholds where one thing can tip another. Let's go back to that situation. If you have somebody that has a workplace incident, you need to think about whether this person has exceptional, extraordinary privilege. And should there be a tip to the person who's accountable for that privilege's execution, that this person is having some challenges? Maybe give them some time off, relieve the pressure, maybe turn up the threshold of interest about what they do with that privilege. But that didn't happen for us. And so that would be one of those process fixes. With respect to the IT and the physical security, I think that's a pretty simple fix, and that's been undertaken. Some of the fixes are perhaps ham-fisted, which is no person can do something alone. It's two-person control. That brings physical control into the IT universe, but that's not terribly efficient. And it is to some degree demeaning to people to say, I don't trust that you'll do it alone unless somebody else is in the room with you. So something more sophisticated might be, anytime somebody crosses a threshold, step in, crosswalk that with what's happening in the physical world. And if it looks like it deserves an explanation, assume noble intent on the party who did this, ask them, what was that all about? Do you need help fixing that? And if you find out in that one case in a million that it was a malicious transgression, we'll deal with that accordingly. So you need to actually crosswalk those things without killing the silos. What I imply, and I'd like to make explicit in that last statement, is that these controls often send the wrong message to the workforce, that you don't trust them. Sends a message that somehow we've got to kind of verify, and as a byproduct that possibly trust. And you need to flip that script. You're going to trust but verify. And not because you think they'll abuse their privileges. Trust but verify because if somebody absconds with their privileges, steals their privileges, that you want to catch that in the earliest possible moment and make that employee whole, assuming the noble intent of that employee until they prove otherwise.
Absolutely. Yeah. Insider threat has always been that major concern. And I think sometimes people, somewhat overlook it from a response activity or a monitoring activity, because like you said, if someone takes someone else's ID and starts doing malicious things with it, it's not going to end well. And those are the things that people need to pick up on, at least from the enterprise. And that's where I, that's my expertise.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the most important insights of all, which is that classically, the Edward Snowden affair is called an insider threat, kind of like at scale. And that's not an inappropriate kind of definition. But it then kind of conjures up the view that insider threat, kind of look at that from the other direction, that insider threat is all about a physical insider. It's not. What insider threat is, the abuse of privilege. It could be an outsider who gets that insider privilege and abuses it. It could be a machine that runs amok, and that's the insider threat. Or it could be an Edward Snowden. Could be someone who's simply complacent, possibly incompetent, who's abusing their privilege, not because they intend to, but because they just don't know how to do it the right way. All of those constitute the broad class, in my view, of insider threat. And if you set your mechanisms up properly, if you kind of try to defend that identity and its reconciliation to the privileges, the authorities that it has within your system, then you catch quite a lot more than the next Edward Snowden. They come along once every 20 years, thank goodness. But you want to catch everything else that comes in between that actually constitutes the same threat, the abuse of privilege inside your system.
So I've been a part of a number of, probably hundreds of ransomware and breaches, and they always seem to be chaos from a customer side. How was it from the, you know, from the NSA side? I have to imagine it was hair on fire for a while.
Well, it was, in so much as, look, I've got a theory of the world that says that organizations live in one of four states. Sometimes they're between those two states, but they'd like to be in peace and tranquility most of the time. That's hard to do these days. The second phase is what I describe as the emergency phase, where you can do what you're supposed to do with all the resources that you have, to include authorities. You don't need outside help, but you have to work harder. You have to turn the rheostat up. You might have to work nights. You might have to dual hat. The third phase is a crisis, where you have to augment your resources. You've got to reach out, seek, and acquire help. Maybe it's technical assistance. Maybe it's legal assistance. Maybe it's public affairs. Maybe you just need more people, more butts in seats.
Yeah.
The fourth phase, which you want to avoid like the plague, is disaster, where permanent harm ensues. The organizations that typically manage that well, manage that best, actually never panic, right? They might work harder in the emergency phase. They might be kind of reaching out hither and yon to resources that are going to augment them in the crisis phase, but they never panic and slide into the abyss. Why? Because they keep the main thing the main thing. They never forget why they're in business. What is it we're expected to do? Solving that crisis might be a means to continue to do what you do, but that's not job one, actually. Job one is to continue to do what you've been chartered to do. At NSA, we reminded ourselves in the summer of 2013 and for the few months after that, every single minute of every single day, our job is to protect the nation. We need to make sure that that remains job one. So all of those things we did to generate the intelligence or the security information, now called cybersecurity, those were the two broad missions. We had to make sure that that remained front and center. That's stabilizing, that essentially calms the herd, so to speak, and it gives people a sense of what the long game is. Meanwhile, you need to make sure that in so doing, that you prevent further harm to that might come from reputation or the cessation of authorities, perhaps the leakage of information that tells other people about what your techniques, your means, your methods are. So address that, but address that because you're actually still focused on job one, the mission, what it is you're trying to get done. And then third, to make sure that you're continually reaffirming to the workers, right, the people in your workplace, that we're okay. We've done the right thing. We've done it the right way. We might not at this moment in time been lauded, you know, far and wide, but you are deserving of trust. You're deserving of the respect. We're going to actually prove that that's true through our performance, more than through emphatic assertion. That was the strategy that we applied during the summer of 2013. And it worked because we were doing the right thing. We were doing it the right way. Snowden was trafficking in allegations more than revelations. And ultimately, because we took the long view and we continued to deliver the goods, deliver our mission, we were affirmed and restored to good health. There was an op-ed that was written by Jeffrey Stone in the summer, I think it was the spring of 2014. He was the person who led the investigation at NSA, but he was not from NSA. He had been the dean of the University of Chicago Law School, close personal friend of President Obama, a card-carrying member of the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. And he kind of laid all this out in an op-ed he wrote in the spring of 2014. It was entitled, What I Told NSA. The op-ed begins with, I thought going to NSA to investigate the Snowden affair, that I would find a rogue organization that was off the rails, doing the wrong thing the wrong way, egregiously violating U.S. person trust and civil liberties. He said the second part, I was shocked, stunned, and amazed to find that that's not what NSA was doing, and it's not what NSA was. It was a law-abiding organization following the law, pursuing its charter. The things that Snowden accurately alleged NSA did, they should do, that they couldn't not do those things because it was within their charter. They were legally obligated to do them, and they did them the right way. But the third part of the op-ed is my favorite part. In the third part of the op-ed, he said, so I've come to conclude that NSA deserves the American people's trust, but we should never trust them. That's the part that I loved, because that's the deal, right? You should be worthy of trust, but never expect it. That applies not just to public sector organizations, but private sector organizations. There'll be a sufficient amount of scrutiny of what you do, how you do it, that there'll always be a doubting Thomas or Thomasina crowd out there that's kind of skeptical, if not cynical. And that's where most of the noise comes from. You need to address that by performing what you do in a way that would, in the fullness of time, make everybody proud. But it's not going to make everybody proud. There's always going to be somebody that continues to decry or allege that something wrong happened. So that was the center line for NSA in 2013. It worked. So it was a very difficult summer for all of us, kind of any one of us, me included. But 8 years later, I was unanimously confirmed as the U.S. National Cyber Director. So you can work your way back out of the trench. You just need to know when to stop digging and when perhaps to seek some assistance and when to continue to plod on.
Right on. Yeah, that, I think it's important for, you know, any type of CIO, CEO in any type of organization is knowing when to get that help. And like you said, when do you engage with the coalition? You should have a group of trusted individuals that you work with, that you know. At some point in time, we have to, you know, we have to rely on our friends.
That's true. And I think there's no script for that. There's no kind of like, there's no set of objective questions. You can say, you know, if I ask these three questions and I get a score less than 70, then I need to go seek help. Your intuition will tell you that. Your muscle memory will tell you that. But you need to inform that with the practice approach, which is think your way through those low probability, high consequence events. Work your way through throwing all sorts of kind of bricks and kind of challenges at yourself in the pretend portion of your life, the practice portion of your life, and then get to know the territory that you're going to work on. The thing that you practice, whether it's one or a million things you're going to practice, will never happen. But the thing that does will be informed by the muscle memory you've developed over that practice period. And you'll know that you either can or cannot weather the storm with your own resources. And if you, as a byproduct of that practice, say, I need to develop some relationships, a coalition, I need to have a break glass box in my enterprise that when I break that glass and reach in, there's a telephone number or kind of a resource there that will come to my aid immediately. It needs to be idling at 100% such that when I say, I need you now, it doesn't say, give me 6 months.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that raises a kind of a question. Does the NSA run what we would call a tabletop, walk through these types of situations? And I would imagine they do.
Quite candidly, in that day, not so much for our internal processes, but quite a lot for the customers that we served. NSA might surprise some, but NSA was born as a combat support agency. And so we're quite good at assisting combat organizations, commands, with thinking through various scenarios, the branches and sequels of DoD planning. We broadened that out to consider then how do you support the civil agencies like the Department of Commerce, Department of State? How do you support other intelligence agencies that are engaged in the collection of intelligence? All of that requires a lot of brainstorming and tabletop exercising. But it's another matter when you then turn that kind of lens camera onto yourself and say, how do I defend the robustness, the resilience of my own infrastructure? Sometimes you know too much about, you know, how difficult it would be to breach that, or you know too much about what perhaps your own expertise is, and you begin to read your own brag sheets. I'm either going to say could properly be accused of not having thought through, what if there was an Edward Snowden? God, we didn't know his name, but what if there was somebody that did that? And what if they played low and slow? And what if they tried to find and exploit the seams between physical security, IT security, and personnel security? What would that look like? Look exactly like what happened in 2013. And it would have been better for us if we had thought our way through that and planned out before it happened, or perhaps even gone further, which is to say, let's look at the incipient conditions that led to that, and let's try to tamp those down with some kind of addressing of the issues that Snowden brought up, which was more not issues of rogue behavior on the part of NSA, but a disagreement he had with NSA. So how do you address that?
So you mentioned that that public narrative that, or the accusation that, or allegations that Snowden put out there. What were some of the misunderstandings that did publicly?
Yeah, so let me give you an example. Edward Snowden kind of called out something called the 215 program. That's a section within a law that allowed NSA to collect telephone and email. But the one that was most notorious was the telephone metadata. That is a number that calls another telephone, the number that was called, and the time and duration of that call. That was the telephone metadata at issue. And Edward Snowden correctly stated, by releasing an order that was given to a telecommunications firm, that NSA was authorized to collect all of it, that we were allowed to collect, you know, the number of a telephone that called into the United States, the number that in the United States was called, and the duration of that call. The order did not authorize NSA to collect the content of that call or the identity of either party on that call. The only thing it allowed you to do was to say, that is a U.S. registered number, and therefore I'm going to stuff that in the database. Why is that? Why? Because NSA had been properly criticized for not realizing that they were listening to a terrorist coordinator in Sana'a, Yemen, which we knew. We knew that he was coordinating some sort of a terrorist plot, but not realizing that the other end of that conversation was in San Diego, California. The vagaries of how the telecommunication systems work was such that NSA could listen to the coordinator, could not hear the terrorist in the United States, and could not see that that number, didn't even know what the number was, couldn't see that that number was physically located in the United States. So NSA was charged to figure out how to detect the crossing of the scene. And so that telephone metadata that I cited earlier was in fact the information collected by NSA under the authorities granted by federal judges, approved by the Congress and the Senate, albeit, you know, the Senate Intelligence Committee and the Congressional Intelligence Committee, and overseen by the Department of Justice and the Department of Defense. All of that was collected by NSA for one purpose only, to ask of that database, is there any known terrorist who is currently in communication with a person in the United States? NSA would never know the answer to that very explicit question, but what it could discern was that that known terrorist was in communication with a telephone number that was registered in the United States.
Okay.
And it was further restricted, so you could only check that when there was one of a few terrorist groups that were known to be actively plotting something against the United States. Al-Qaeda is an obvious choice. Hezbollah is an obvious choice. There was one or two others, but you could only check it then. All of that said, in the whole of 2012, the year before Snowden came out, NSA checked that database 288 times. And the query always looks something like this. Is this known terrorist whose telephone number we know in contact with a number that's registered in the United States? Yes or no? We did that 288 times. We got a hit, a positive hit, 13 times. Turns out in 12 of those occasions, the number that the terrorist was in contact with had roamed outside the United States. NSA would not know that because NSA would not know the location of the number. But the FBI, when we tipped then, could figure that out. In one of those 13 cases, the telephone number was in Denver. Again, NSA wouldn't know that. The FBI figured that out. It was associated with somebody in the United States that was actively attempting to conduct a terrorist activity. And the FBI eventually caught him. Now, the program's criticized because the FBI already had some information on him. So the program didn't identify him. It elevated his priority. But I've told that whole story just now, and I know it gets very long in the telling, because I firmly believe that if I had told that story to the American people, I told it to the Congress, I told it to the Department of Defense, told it to the Department of Justice before Snowden came out. But if I told the American people that, and I told them how carefully that program is used and offered some proof as to why we were so conservative in its use, most people would have said, well, yeah, we expect you to do that. Detect the crossing of the scene. Keep the terrorists kind of out of this country. They would have said, there's no there there. But because I didn't tell that story first, Snowden told that story first and told it in the most vilifying, titillating, interesting way. You can never go second. People will say, no, I've heard the story. It's a really interesting story. It's a hair on fire story. And whatever you could possibly tell me is not half as interesting. But that's why I said, if you expect the confidence of the American people, or for that matter, any other broad population that are your constituents, you need to tell them first before somebody else does what you do, why you do it, how you do it, so that they can be comfortable with it.
Yeah. And I think that even goes, and thank you for that. I think that goes not only from the, you know, looking at it from the government side, but in the business world, in the enterprise world, if an organization's hit by a cyber attack, don't wait 3 weeks. it, you know, obviously you have to investigate it. You have to confirm that it's really an attack, really a ransomware, really they took information. But there's so many times where organizations put their head in the sand from a outside world perspective. And I always think it's more damaging for them when they do come out and say, oh, well, yeah, we lost, you know, a billion records.
If you can't tell that story before somebody else actually kind of plays that story out, then you have just learned something that's extremely valuable. You can change the course of history. But if you can tell that story and you feel confident that you've got a good story, tell it. This is what I hold in terms of your PII. This is why I hold it. This is what I've done to protect it. You might tease in that this is not without some risk, but that risk is offset by the enormous advantage that you have because I've done this on your behalf. I've actually delivered convenience with the smallest amount of risk. If you tell that story up front, somebody might still scream when it's all said and done, but most population is going to say, nah, you told me, I understood. Those folks that were screaming in the corner weren't paying attention at the time, but I was. And so you've got me, you've got the majority.
Yeah, absolutely. So how did the Snowden incident, how did it reshape the NSA's approach to identity access and threat monitoring?
Well, in several ways. Most systems of interest have three components. There's a technology piece, there's a people piece, skills, right? The behaviors, the expectations, the accountability, and there's a doctrinal piece. And by that, I mean, have you assigned your roles, responsibilities, expectations to the broad components of your otherwise complicated organization? You got to solve all of those. So let me talk about those in the reverse order. Doctrinally, we made it a point to tell ourselves and to then behave accordingly that insider threat was important, not just for others, but important for us. And that we kind of expanded the definition of that to say it's not just about the next literal insider, the next Edward Snowden, but about any abuse of privilege. If a machine runs amok and it doesn't use the privilege assigned to it appropriately, we need to find that and restore very quickly. If there's an outsider who steals kind of an insider's credentials, we need to find that and make that identity whole as quickly as possible, but give it the broadest possible definition. Then assign the responsibility for that, not just to the IT kind of organization, but to the entirety of the organization, IT, physical security, personnel security, and the operations teams, which often kind of make decisions that implicate the degree of risk we're taking in that. This becomes then a corporate goal, which is assigned broadly and measured kind of individually, discreetly, kind of in the various silos. So doctrinally, you got to get that in the right place. Skill-wise, you need to make sure people understand several things. One is, what is insider threat really? Right? Is it we just looking for that literal insider, or is it something bigger, broader? And if you can define it that way, and everybody is not simply an employee of the organization, they're owners, right? Then they could begin to look for those moments when that perhaps might be at risk. Somebody using a system that sees something that's slightly anomalous can say, hey, this is what they were talking about. And I'm an owner here. I'm not an employee. I'm not going to wait for somebody else to detect it. I see it, right? So get the skills in the right place. User training, kind of user awareness, kind of user commitment. And then finally, go to the technology corner. In a technology consistent with the doctrine I laid out, consistent with the skills I laid out, you can up that, right? You can look for those things that are low and slow and that in the aggregate constitute, that just doesn't make sense. You're looking for an anomaly in the context of itself, not something that crosses some bright yellow or bright red line, but something that actually says all of these don't make sense. And now that I've cross-connected IT and physical and kind of the personnel issues that I can tip and cue with, I can see this using some form of technology. Encrypt your data at rest. Snowden steals 1.5 million documents, but he doesn't have the privilege necessary to read any one of them because he's just a system administrator who's assisting other people to use their privilege. The rest of that gets pretty boring and droll kind of as soon as I start to talk about it. But just to say that talking about it and addressing it and saying it's something I need to solve before it actually bites me, that's the right first step.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of those important pieces is sometimes organizations, they, I don't want to again use that, bury their heads in the sand, but if you identify risk and you identify issues, don't ignore it. You know, step forward and, you know, see what you can do from an organizational level to help fix it.
Yeah, across our careers, we've probably all heard this 100 times, that everything you need to know to succeed in an organization you learned in kindergarten. I think that's true, actually. That's still true. Yeah. And it might well be that, you know, one of the most important questions is, what do you think is going to happen under these circumstances? You've accepted this low probability, high consequence risk. If we ever suffer it, and across infinity of time, you will suffer low probability risks, maybe multiple, yeah, right? What do you think is going to happen? And if you don't have a good answer for that, if you say, well, I'll resign from the organization and my retirement starts that day, that's a terrible answer, right?
That's horrible.
But expect a rational answer. And I think that is the thing that I would emphasize most strongly at all. I'm often asked, we're all asked, what keeps us awake at night? And I wish I could say what the former Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, once said, which is nothing, I keep other people awake. That's not my lot in life. But my answer, classically, is it's not the transgressors in my world. And in the case of cyber, it might be at the moment the Chinese, or the Russians, or ransomware actors. It's not that. They do cause some amount of anxiety and perhaps restlessness. But what really keeps me awake is this phenomenon that I call proactive ambivalence. What does that mean? It means that most people are aware that these are issues, that these low probability kind of events are possible and that they would have extraordinarily high consequences. But then they immediately assume, this is where the ambivalence comes in, that either that will manage itself or somebody else is going to manage that. They immediately just assume it away. That's not my issue. That's not my problem. That's especially true for boards, right, or leaders of corporations, whether they're agencies or private sector organizations, who know that cyber is an issue, who know that at the core of that, the abuse of identity is an issue. That's not something hard to get your head around, who then assume that it's been handled, right? That somebody somewhere has taken care of that. Somebody's defending the cloud. Somebody's defending my stuff in the cloud. Somebody's defending the kind of the various kind of networks that I rely on all day, every day. And if you assume that that person is somebody that has complete control of that and has achieved a degree of absolute security, then you've not actually kind of wrestled with that enough. You need to remove that proactive ambivalence and ask the hard questions. Are we dependent on digital infrastructure? What are the things that could go wrong with that? What have we done to mitigate those things? What risk remains? Are those acceptable risks? What can I do to perhaps buy those risks down still further? What would we do if we suffer one of those risks? All of those questions I've just asked require no expertise whatsoever in Python or kind of computer science. They're plain language questions you can ask the boardroom to the line leadership, first line leadership. And those are the questions we don't ask often enough in a world where we're existentially dependent upon digital infrastructure.
I think that is probably my biggest takeaway right now, is that proactive ambivalence. And it kind of hits hard now that I think about it. From a lessons learned perspective, you know, if you were to sit down with a CEO of a company, a CIO of a company, what would you share with them from a perspective of, this is what we learned from this incident, and
let me bend that into two broad bends and have a couple of things in each one. First, the strategic bend, the very strategic bend, you know, big S strategy.
Yeah.
Get to know what your low probability, high consequence events are. And when you get to know those, don't focus and then kind of have some confidence that you're okay because they're low probability. Focus on the high consequence. And try to imagine what you would do in the moment. Point two, when you work your way through that, you probably then will discover that you enjoy some risk. And I say that kind of in a euphemistic way. And that enjoying that risk means you'll one day suffer that risk. You need to explain to the degree you believe is appropriate and necessary to all the stakeholders who would be swept up in that, why that risk is appropriate, necessary, and what you've done to cover down on it. Tell that story first and develop, as a third part of this strategy box, develop the relationships that will be helpful to you in that time of crisis. Now, in the world that I live in most days, the cyber world, because I am a cyber hammer, eternally in search of a cyber nail, those relationships would be kind of, who are the adjacents in your sector that are not trying to solve similar problems, similar challenges, the same. So make sure you're connected to them. because if you need to reach out, you want somebody to understand your business, not just the IT underpinnings of that business. Reach out to the first responders that you would likely call in that moment. If it's kind of in preparation for a ransomware event, might be the Mandiants, the CrowdStrikes, others of that ilk of the world who come in and tell you what's going on. Yeah. But you might want to have on call a ransomware negotiator, right? And you might want to be on a first name basis with them. So if they say, well, I think I can book you, maybe I fit you in the next 6 months, right? You want this to be at the ready. So think about all of those assets and have that relationship up front. And yes, some of those relationships are going to be with the government. Because when the FBI shows up or your regulator shows up, maybe a regulated entity, you want them to have a preconceived notion about your competence and your diligence so that they give you the benefit of a doubt. The first time they ever show up is to address kind of the mess on the cleanup on aisle nine, broken glass and all sorts of kind of odious vapors, right? Then they're not going to give you that benefit of a doubt. So establish that relationship up front. That's the strategic box. In the tactical box, if you think about security within your corporation, your enterprise, and you think about that through multiple different lenses, and you assign each of those lenses to a different party, and they're at the end of the day, then by virtue of that, siloed from one another, that's dangerous. It's really dangerous. Because security, actually, at the end of the day, doesn't know boundaries. It might know different modes, might know different means by which it's going to come to you. But at the end of the day, security is something that kind of helps you have viability in the company or restore viability in the moment that it's lost. And therefore, all of the attributes that essentially kind of order in or bear on security, you need to connect at some place somehow. Make sure, as a second tactical issue, that you worked your way through at the boardroom and various levels below that, the crises that you might imagine. Do the practice, and then address afterwards what are the things that didn't go particularly well, and tee those up as to whether those are things you can buy down. But offer yourself the time machine that says, I want to experience it now, not in the theater of the real. And I want to therefore change the future by making those investments now. But you only get that if you run the practice exercise. And then the last thing that I would say is never assume you have a secure system. The best you can do is to have a defensible system, which must then be defended. And it must be defended in real time, not kind of in batch mode every once in a while. So what you're looking for are anomalies in the context of themselves. It might not look like anything like the thing that happened to somebody else or the thing that happened to you before. It might be sufficiently new and novel that it's dressed in a costume that you can't recognize. And if you're thinking in a very practical sense, does this make sense? And sometimes it doesn't, then bore in on that. Kind of figure out what's going on there. The best quality for a CISO might be to have a paranoid schizophrenic CISO. I'm joking on that. But somebody that's sufficiently skeptical, sufficiently kind of cynical about this makes sense, that they've got to prove it to themselves. That's zero trust in the form of a human being, as opposed to zero trust in the form of technology. That's a long list, but hopefully one that comports with common sense. I learned all of that richly in the moment of Edward Snowden. You might have thought that I and anybody else kind of in a position like that would have known that implicitly, reflexively. But we all know that we're busy. Ops consumes us, right? And the nature of risk is sometimes something that you say, I can't solve all of those in advance, and so I'll deal with it when I come to it. Some of these won't wait for that. Some of these will not be gracious if you do.
Very cool. Yeah, and I don't think AI is going to help us on that part.
No, if five Russians can pretend to be 5,000 Americans, imagine what generative AI machine can do.
Exactly. Chris, thank you so much for your discussion today and the events around the Snowden. This was a superb discussion. Where can people find more about you online, follow your work?
Well, I'm a strategic advisor to Semperis, which has been so kind to host this session. So that's the way to find me. And if you've ever known my email address, you still do. I haven't changed it in 25 years. And I'm on LinkedIn. I think that what I have relayed to you is something that any number of people can relay. It simply requires kind of a thoughtful, and maybe not in my case thoughtful, but a studied kind of review of the material on the table and a practical, common sense-based way forward of, does my position make sense? Are the risks that I'm taking make sense? If there's one skill that's perhaps undervalued in the realm of cybersecurity above all others, it's common sense and or critical thinking. Maybe they're tied for first, right? If you can do that, then you can outrun any number of Python programmers and all sorts of other wizards in this space. Common sense and critical thinking to go with that is perhaps the tool of first regard. So resort to that. If need be, call me and I'm happy to talk about this kind of at RSA or DEF CON or Black Hat, maybe on the backside of kind of some bar at Annapolis, but do call.
Awesome. I look forward to our next discussion, either at HIP in South Carolina, I believe, this year, or the next time I have you on the podcast.
Great. Thanks a lot, Jeff, and good luck to us going forward.
Thank you. If you like today's episode, please subscribe and review the podcast and visit us at Semperis.com. This episode was brought to you by Semperis, leaders in AI-powered identity security and resilience. Thank you.